You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to Reality Check Radio. You with Marie here with Counterculture. Joining me now from Resist Gender Education is Fern Hickson. Good morning, Fern. How are you?
Good morning, Marie. Very well, thank you.
It is so great to have you here. I realise it's been about a year since we checked in with Marg Kurno, and she is stepping back to do so much of the work that she does, and you have stepped up as spokesperson for Resist Gender Education. Now, it's been a year, so just remind our listeners what it is that you do as an organisation.
Yes, we've been going about 3 years now, and we're a group of women who are represent a broad range of people. So we're educators, both retired, and we do have some who are still working. We're parents, non-parents. We have lesbians in our group, and we have all the political views, and we have Christians and atheists as well in our group. So it's a very good broad representation. And our goal is to let people know what is being taught to children in schools, which we consider to be ideological and very harmful, and to help them navigate through the school system so that they can, particularly parents, can have their voice heard. And of course, also we are lobbying politicians and trying to get some change that way.
When I spoke to Marg last year, there was a lot of work that was starting to happen, and there were a lot of proposed curriculum changes, some that had already been introduced and some that were proposed. What are some of the changes, if any, have you observed in the space, in the educational space, in that last 12 months? What changes have occurred?
The main change is that we've had a change of government, and the coalition agreement says that the REC, that's the Relationship and Sexuality Education Guide, will be withdrawn and rewritten. And that statement came out from the coalition late November or early December. I think it was late November. And of course, we were very cheered by that. But here we are, and it's May, late May, and nothing has happened in that field. I think that Erica Stanford, the Minister of Education, is very busy sorting out literacy and numeracy and other problems in school, and this is just on the back burner. But, of course, we are very concerned because every day that goes by is another child being told that it's possible to be born in the wrong body, that humans could actually change sex. And if you tell a 6 to 8 or even maybe to a 10-year-old that humans can change sex, they'll believe you because they're children and they believe what adults are told. So we very urgently want the RSC guide to be withdrawn and rewritten. And so we've been lobbying Erica Stanford for that, but we haven't really had a positive response from her. We also have met with Tanya Unkevich, who's New Zealand First MP, and she's very interested in this topic and is, very willing to progress having some changes made.
So when you say she wasn't a positive response, define that for me.
From Erica Stanford, she has declined to meet with us 3 times now. The latest time was I don't know if you've heard about the Mental Health Foundation open letter. In April, they launched an open letter in which they misled the public. They said that the government was planning to cancel sex education altogether, which is just not true, and asked for people to sign the open letter. And they got about 4,000 signatures to it. I think after a week or two, they corrected it, because they realised they had actually misled the public, but still, people have signed it. So we launched our own open letter, and our open letter is asking for the guides to be withdrawn and rewritten, and we actually support relationships and sexuality education in schools as long as it's scientifically factual and age-appropriate. And a lot of what's in the RSC guide is not factual or age-appropriate, so that's why it needs to be rewritten. Our open letter is just closed, and we've got about 690 signatures to it, which is a lot less than the Mental Health Foundation, but also we don't have the resources of the Mental Health Foundation. We're entirely a voluntary group, and our funding is just donations from, small donations from ordinary parents and citizens.
I mean, that to me speaks of the ideological capture in foundations like the Mental Health Foundation. I mean, are you coming up against that?
Definitely. I heard an interview with the CEO of the Mental Health Foundation. I think it was on News Talk, and he was woefully ill-informed. He was asked when children first taught about gender ideology, and he didn't know. Sorry, gender identity, they called it. He didn't know. He's defending guidelines that he hasn't read or certainly hasn't looked at closely. So children are actually being taught from when they're old enough to have a picture book read to them. So 2 and 3 year old children are being taught that when they're born, adults make a guess about what sex they are, and sometimes they get it wrong. So those boxes, there's dozens of them in school libraries, public libraries, early childhood centres. So that's when it starts. And then from year one in primary school, one of the goals is 4 or 5 year olds is to teach them that there is such a thing as gender identity. And this is just a nebulous concept that has no scientific basis at all, and is the first step towards leading children down a pathway of body dissociation and separating your mind from your body and thinking that you can remake your body to suit whatever you're thinking. So it's delusional thinking.
I just find it unbelievably ironic that it's the Mental Health Foundation that are doing this, considering the mental health implications that have now been proven by children who are confused about their gender and the stress that it places them under. And that, from what I've seen and read, that affirmation of this fanciful notion is actually detrimental to a young person's mental health, not positive for it.
Absolutely, especially for the younger children. So it's not until a child is maybe 6 or 7 that they actually understand, in the normal course of events, that they understand that sex is defined at conception and you can't change it. You know, that even if a woman puts trousers on, she's still a woman. A man puts a dress on, he's still a man. So it takes quite a long time for a child's maturity, their ability to think, to develop enough that they can form that opinion. So what we're doing is our RSE guide is actually disrupting that natural progression at 5 by telling them that what you think about how you feel, whether you feel masculine or feminine, is more important than your physical body. And, of course, those feelings are all based on sex stereotypes, which is so aggressive to be using them as a way of deciding what a child's personality is.
So now, like in the past year, there has been a lot of conversations now. A lot of parents, and especially through the lockdown years, became aware of the level of gender education that had crept into schools and have started speaking up. What impact is that having on some schools? Because I know that these guidelines, how vigorously they adopt them is up to each individual school. So do you have some schools who are more active in this education than others, and others that actually listen to their parent parental body and say, you know what, we're just going to give this a light touch? I mean, what is the spectrum you're seeing out there?
Yes, definitely there are schools which, well, there are some schools that don't teach what's in the guideline already because they've already decided they, you know, don't, that doesn't suit their school or they don't agree with it. And then there are other schools where if the parents get together and go to the Board of Trustees meeting, they can persuade them that the guidelines are not fit for purpose. So we have had some success there. But there are also schools where the guidelines are fully endorsed and fully implemented and any approach to the school is quite often, the response to it is quite often belligerent and, you know, treating the parent who's asking for a change as if they're bigoted and unreasonable. So it's the whole spectrum. But an interesting thing we discovered 2 years ago, or actually I think it was 3 years ago now, we tried to survey schools to find out how many transgender students they had. And we got answers from about 90 schools, but we also had about 40 who wouldn't answer. And we ended up having to go to the ombudsman, and in the end, the ombudsman ruled that the schools were allowed to keep that information private, even though it was all going to be anonymised and we were just finding out how many transgender students there were in the country. So we had a very limited sample, but 3 years ago we counted at least 70 schools with transgender students, and of course that will be much higher now. And what surprised us was that it was right through the country. We thought it would just be in the main centres. No, it was right through. We even had schools on the West Coast who had transgender students. And we also noticed that most schools, it wasn't just one or two. It was 8 or 16, you know. So it seemed obvious that there was a social contagion. And the other interesting thing is that by far the majority of the students were identifying as non-binary. Mm. And so we figure that that means that we've got a whole cohort of kids growing up who are very uncomfortable with the sex stereotypes they're being presented with in you know, entertainment media. And so they're opting out of the sex stereotypes by saying they're non-binary. But of course, that impacts on everybody around them, because then they want to be called they and them, and it's very difficult for people to do that, and especially for neurodivergent or new English learners. So it's not an ideology that is comfortable for other people, and it's just walking roughshod over other people's rights and other people's feelings.
Mm. It's interesting you say that. Like, I know that because I've got sons at a normal boys' school, but we talk about this openly a lot, and they say, particularly with the girls, they see a lot of this with their compatriots at their sister school that they are with, and the social contagion element is strong. So if you have someone within a social group that identifies as non-binary, next minute, the rest of them in that social group will start identifying the same way as part of being accepted. As a child, as being a teenager in the 80s, I remember the whole New Romantic movement where boys were wearing lots of feminine clothes and ruffles and hair and makeup, and I had a very close friend who definitely embraced the whole sort of New Romantic, and then it sort of morphed into the whole Gothic scene. But it was just a part of self-identification in terms of expressing themselves, and it was a phase that they moved through over time, and they were still who they were. Whereas now there seems to be a push, and it does worry me that it has been affirmed within schools to rush actually what is a natural process of teenage experimentation, where the thing that will actually cure them of their so-called rapid onset gender dysphoria is simply time.
Exactly. And one of the doctors in the UK said he was a goth as a young man, and he said that he was very relieved that it wasn't possible to have your eyeliner tattooed on at the time, because he would have had that done. The problem is now, the problem isn't young people experimenting with their presentation and their gender. The problem is that they're being encouraged to make permanent decisions about that when they're very young. And so, you know, a couple of weeks ago there was a mother interviewed on radio, and she had a 14-year-old son who was being put on estrogen, and she was just completely blasé about the fact that that was making him sterile. And the news media, nobody in the news media said, hang on a minute, is this really what a 14-year-old should be deciding. So, yes, schools are a pipeline for teaching kids these ideas, and in the RSE guide, one of the more concerning parts of it is that for 12-year-olds, so intermediate age, in science it suggests teaching children about hormone blockers. So, you know, that's just wrong to be teaching 12-year-olds about that, especially now that we've had the CAS review, which has said that there's no evidence that hormone blockers are either safe or effective.
Well, there's plenty, indeed, and it is concerning that, I mean, what did Jan Rivers say to me the other day? We're prescribing these at 11 times the rate that they are in the UK.
That's right.
And when you finally have a body of work, such as the CAS review, where the detractors saying, oh, you can't dismiss that out of hand. I mean, what was that, a four-year body of work?
Yes.
By an eminent paediatrician. So a lot of thought has gone in there. And it is difficult. So as you said, there's obviously the health side of things with the health, Ministry of Health, the education side of things. It's interesting that you say that you're finding a sympathetic ear with Tania Unkevich as a debutante MP. She seems to be rolling her sleeves up and actually climbing into some of these trickier cultural issues, which is heartening.
Yes, when I met her recently, I found that she had herself suffered from anorexia as a teenager, and she's also has a diploma in counselling. So she has a lot of background experience in mental health issues, and so this is, you know, this is probably why she's taking a particular interest in it. Mm-hmm. And I think it was her that has put in the bathrooms bill as well, where there should be single sex facilities in public spaces, which of course is getting a lot of people annoyed, and they point out some of the flaws in it. But I'm looking at it from a school perspective. We have anecdotal evidence of girls not wanting to use the toilets anymore because they have to share them with boys, and the boys don't always bother to, you know, make sure they don't leave a mess behind because they don't have to sit on the toilet. So, you know, the girls are having to clean up a mess from the boys, or else they are worried about being bullied by them in these enclosed cubicles. So we've anecdotal evidence of an increase in urinary tract infections from girls holding on all day at school rather than use the toilet. This is just another example of why women and girls need single-sex toilets and changing rooms.
And this is the thing I really find quite amazing. And again, it comes, so I do a lot of work in the cultural space, and I look at what I call the victimized or oppression totem. In terms of your victimhood status, you get greater, you go higher up the totem. And of course, trans is at the top of the totem. If you were a black disabled trans person, man, you'd win the oppression lottery, right? So trans tends to trump anything else in that school space. And I look at that, and I know that in larger co-educational schools, you know, there are Polynesian girls, very conservative Polynesian girls, you know, that have been struggling with having males in those spaces. And young Muslim women, I wonder about them. I mean, in the larger cities, you know, you do have cohorts of these girls. I'm surprised that both those cultural areas have they spoken up around this, because I'm sure that any Muslim dad would not be very, very happy about a genetically and biological male being allowed in their daughter's private space.
I'm sure. So a lot of schools still do have single-sex spaces, and so some parents won't be complaining because it's not affecting them yet. It's only in schools, it's only new buildings or refurbishments where they make them unisex. But we've also discovered that it's up to the school how they label it. So the ministry requires all new toilets to be enclosed cubicles, floor to ceiling, and opening off a public space, a little bit like a whole row of portaloos.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the requirement from the ministry. And schools, if they don't look closely at the regulations, think that they have to label them unisex. But no, actually, they can label this set here as for girls and this set over there as for boys, and they can keep a couple and make them unisex. So that's the solution to that, but a lot of schools don't realise it.
Mm. I want to get your thoughts on a couple of other things that are going on at the moment. One of them was the recent Pink Shirt Day, which is for anti-bullying, but it seemed to, again, has been hijacked by trans activists and trans allies, and it was specifically for, the fundraising was for trans and non-binary students and bullying there. What are your thoughts around that? I mean, that it wasn't widely communicated on that, but that has certainly been a change in recent years. Is that just another part of the slippery slope of how the T's are taking over?
Yes, it's just another example of how being trans, as you say, is the top of the victim totem pole. And whatever trans want is to be granted without consideration to others. So in the RSE guide for schools, it says that transgender students should be permitted to use whichever toilet they like. Every other student has to use the toilet of their sex. So there's a privilege there that other people don't have. And with Pink Shirt Day, it did start off about discouraging bullying. But now the only kind of bullying they're looking at is bullying against trans people. There's all sorts of other bullying goes on in schools, and it's just ignored. Or, you know, there's no discussion of it. Children are bullied for being overweight or being a bit awkward, or for having a lisp, or, you know, any number of things they're bullied for. And the focus is all on the small number of students who might identify as transgender. And the Mental Health Foundation is just part of the, Pink Shirt Day is just part of the jigsaw of all the organisations, all our government agencies and organisations have been captured by this ideology and are promoting it to kids.
Mm. The Autism Foundation is the one that really intrigues me, because those who have neurodiversity, and let's face it, there are more of these kids than there's ever been before.
Mm.
And that population, that neurodiverse population, seem to be the most vulnerable to gender ideology and gender identity. They're overrepresented significantly in that group. And it amazes me again that they are, instead of investigating, discussing and protecting, they're encouraging.
Mm. I don't know what Autism New Zealand, I think that's the name of the organisation, I don't know what their stance is on this, but I do know that the CAS review found that in the cases that the review studied, 16.6% had been diagnosed as autistic. Whereas in the whole population in the UK, it's a 1% to 2% population of autism. So it's hugely overrepresented. And it is understandable, because a person with autism does stand out to be different and is often ostracised by their peers, not deliberately, but just because they're different, they don't kind of fit into the group. And then if the autistic person says, I'm trans, suddenly they're top of the pedestal and they're stunning and brave and they've got friends, you know, welcoming them, and they've got an explanation for why they're a bit different. And all of the news media, entertainment media, online, everywhere, tells them that changing their sex is possible and is the panacea for all their problems. So it's understandable why they would turn to this ideology. And it's one of the strongest reasons why it shouldn't be taught in schools, because it's putting an idea into a kid's head that they might then pursue and then, you know, end up doing things like the girl a week or so ago who tried to cut off her own breast. And there's another example of the news media not being shocked that someone would be so mentally unwell that they would do that to themselves, but saying that that's an example of why our health system isn't serving the needs of transgender people.
Yeah, I know I discussed that with my Media Matters partner a few weeks ago. And yeah, indeed. So with saying that, with what you've said, Pride Week, Pride in Schools is about to kick off in June.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that again is, it's almost like a, I mean, now I'm going to preface this and say I have zero problems with children identifying in terms of homosexuals or lesbians. And look, they can do what they want. But what worries me is this whole celebration at schools, and that there's a specific focus on pride with T's.
Yes, the T has taken over pride, without a doubt. And there's a very big difference between being accepting and tolerant of homosexuality, which most New Zealanders are now, and having your school library decorated with the Pride Progress flag, which has the chevron for transgender. Those kind of over-the-top celebrations are not done for any other thing. Maybe Christmas is the only other time when there's a lot of, you know, decoration in a school, but there's no other ideology that ever has that kind of presentation in a school. You don't see, you know, Christian crosses everywhere or Muslim flags everywhere, but for Pride Week, it's all over the place. And I think it's discussing homosexual issues is a topic that's suitable for secondary school, but there's no reason it should be in primary school, and there's no reason why five-year-olds should be colouring in all the different flags. There's something like 30 different flags for rainbow people, transgender, bigender, agender, you know, bisexual. There's flags for all of them. Kids don't need to know that. Primary school kids don't need to know that. But the other really concerning thing about Pride Week is that Inside Out publishes a list of books called Out on the Shelves. And when you look at them, some of them, I think, are actually breaking our censorship laws, which say that you can't discuss sexual matters with under 16-year-olds. So some of the ones they recommend for intermediate and young teens are very sexually explicit relationships. So there's another concern that parents need to watch to see what's being bought for the kids' school library.
Mm. So with all of that being said, I mean, I know at Resist Gender Education, you've been pulling together resources to help. So if parents are listening to this and they're thinking, oh, might need to check what's going on at school. And I know I've got another guest. She's telling me, you know, for that Pride Week, she pulls her moko out of school for that week. She said, no, I'm not. I'm just not going to take the risk.
A lot of parents are doing that. And another good piece of news, though, is that there are schools who have participated in the past, and since parents have complained, they're not participating anymore.
That's good news.
Yeah, so parents just need to they need to go and talk to their principal and board of trustees, and it's better to go with two or three so that you can't be written off as just one bigot. And it is possible to change the board or change the school practice.
And what were sort of resources? I know you've got a great website. So what sort of resources, if they're wanting to arm themselves with information to take to these meetings, have you got anything there you can provide them to be able to sit down and have these discussions with their educators and education governance?
Yes, I recommend, if you need some help, go to our website, which is www.resistgendereducation.nz, and you'll see a tab that says Parent Power, and under that there's a manual for parents which describes the things you can do. There's also a page with letter templates. There's about 8 letter templates there, which you can adapt to suit your own circumstances. And we also have a Substack, and you can sign up for that, and then all the latest news and our latest writing goes on there. But you can also find that on our website. There's a link to it on our website.
Oh, that's honestly, that's brilliant, Fern. And I have to say, I've just finished Abigail Schreier's Irreversible Damage, and I'm 2/3 of the way through Helen Joyce's Trans. Especially the latter text has a lot, debunks a lot of the myths and how flimsy this trans ideology is actually based on the work, the academic work that's based on it. That's quite a powerful tool, I have to say.
Yeah, those two books, I think, are the two best books you can read. They're very readable. You know, you don't have to be academic to read them. And as the CAS review found out, this whole thing, this whole ideology is based on very shaky foundations, and this is why you can't get transgender advocates to have a discussion, because they've got no scientific basis to their views. It's all just a belief system.
Indeed.
So, you know, if they say that a trans woman is a woman, so they say a man is a woman, and when you say, well, how did that happen, they actually can't tell you the steps, because there aren't any steps. A man can't turn into a woman. And so because they can't defend that, they won't discuss it. None of them will have a debate about it, and they hide behind saying, oh, I'm not going to platform bigots, you know. But we have the science and we have the evidence on our side. We just have to keep talking to the schools. I think because the Minister of Education is being very slow to act, then parents need to step up and go to their Board of Trustees and ask them to remove the current RSE guide. It is causing harm to children. And just teach factual sex education, and of course how to have a healthy relationship, and that consent is important. And unfortunately these days children do need to be helped to manage their exposure to pornography, because they're being exposed to it very young, often by mistake when they're actually looking for something else and it just pops up on their screen. So those things are important. That's what our open letter asks the minister to do. And I think parents need to take it into their own hands and go and try to get their school to withdraw the guidelines while we're waiting for the government to actually, act on their policy.
Mm. Indeed. And if you have heard this in regards to pornography, I've done a series of interviews around this. Anything I've done with Helen Taylor from Exodus Cry, she runs a foundation in the United States that's done a tremendous amount of work on this over there. And also, too, I did interview the sexual abuse nurse examiner Heidi Olson a few months back. That interview is exceptionally powerful and actually tackles this issue head on. And she works at the absolute coalface on the effects of pornography with children. So if you want to find out a little bit more about both of those topics, do have a look at those interviews on my replays. So that website again is resistgendereducation.nz for all of that information and those resources. Yeah, and it's just being a bit brave, isn't it, Fern, and just starting those conversations with those key leaders in schools and just saying, hey, you know, actually, you don't have to do this, and there's some of us that are deeply concerned.
Yes, that's right. And as I say, go with it, you know, two or three other parents, because that gives you more clout, and, you know, you're more likely to be listened to, and also you have witnesses for what was discussed. And I encourage people, even though this is a very, very emotional topic, and we all, you know, the best approach to school authorities is to have your information and your facts at your fingertips, and just to be calm and reasonable in your requests. And it's perfectly reasonable to ask schools not to teach children that they can change their sex, because they can't. And it's really harmful for all children when that's being taught to them.
Hey, look, this has been Fern Hickson from Resist Gender Education. Fern, thank you so much for your time this morning. It's been fascinating. And give my best to Marg as well. It's been so great to catch up with you.
Thanks very much, Marie.
You're most welcome.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.